Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Shares for beginners.
We scan the news to find every story that actually that agrees with us, and that is it's a human trait. We always search our environment to confirm that we're right on things. We don't look for conflicting ideas and conflicting advice. So that was a huge lesson, and I was very, very attached to the fairy tale ending. The kind of, I think it's known as the narrative fallacy now. The fact that stories. We all believe in a Hollywood ending, and we think that you know, a share has got to end up in that closure of the story that we're looking for. But the reality is messy, and it doesn't work like that.
G'day, and welcome back to Shares for Beginners. I'm Phil Mascatello. What are the behavioural biases that hamper the returns of investors? Does a world-class education and experience in the finance industry inoculate you from getting things wrong? To find out more, I'm joined today by Ed Croft from Stockopedia to discuss all of this and more. G'day, Ed.
G'day. Good to see you, Phil.
Yeah, thanks for coming here. So Ed's been the steward of the Stockopedia mission since day one with the goal of building a systematic toolkit to solve his own behavioural biases. Ed was an Oxford scholar, graduating with first-class honours before going on to work as an asset manager and private client broker at Goldman Sachs. So tell us about your time at Goldman Sachs. What was your role?
Well, it was a long time ago, and as you said, I was working in the private clients department, and we were really dealing with ultra high net worth individuals, being Goldman's. They had that cachet and brand to bring in, very, very wealthy individuals. And I worked in a very small team running up to $1.5 to $2 billion US dollars in private client assets. And it was a mixture of execution-only brokerage for some particularly proactive individuals, and then most of it discretionary. Mm-hmm. So we invested, you know, they gave us the mandate to invest on their behalf, and so on. So it was quite an education. It was on the equities floor. It was not on the asset management floor back then. So this was sort of pre-.com up to .com when it was particularly hot in that department. And after the .com bubble, they basically separated it and they split it off from the equities department and merged it into the asset management department. And it was all on a commission basis back then, which meant that there were some tensions.
You lived and died by the sword, did you?
Well, there were definitely tensions in that you were incentivized to deal.
Yeah.
And that meant you weren't necessarily acting on the best interest at times of the clients, which wasn't something which really sat well with me, I have to admit.
Yeah. I think that is a bit of a problem in the industry as well, you know, some of the incentives that people that ordinary investors come along and trust people, but not even thinking about the incentives that are involved.
Exactly. That's very true. And I think that happens all across the industry and even today, and it's that power of incentives which really drives behavior, and it always has. And I think that really sowed the seed for me to try and move towards, you know, more self-reliance in investing. And I ended up, really, if I look back on my journey, it's about everything I do now is about trying to sort of develop tools and information education for private investors, or retail investors, you might call them here, to make their own decisions, to try and be able to avoid some of those issues that befall those who become clients of, you know, of different institutions, which may not have their best interests at heart. Not say they all don't. I know some very, very fantastic professionals and fantastic businesses out there that
some people have morals to
absolutely
work in the industry.
Yeah, they do, yeah.
What did you read at Oxford?
I read chemistry. So okay. I was a scientist, and I did a 4-year degree, and that really made me think deeply on, you know, numeracy and all kinds of analytical ways of measuring and analyzing all kinds of things. And I think that's what I remember. I really don't remember the chemistry now, so don't ask me to read out the periodic table. I am much more of somebody who just sort of applied that kind of method of thinking to everything I did since.
So did your experience with science, does that have any bearing in the way that you think about investing?
It definitely does. I began applying more data. I was very attracted to the more data-driven side of investing from a young age. And my father got me into investing by leaving me a little tax-efficient portfolio to sort of manage on my own. And when I started reading books on some of the traits of, you know, stock market winners and interested in reading around the subject. And I think I had a lot of kind of missteps along the way, and I'm sure I'll talk about some of them later. But I always bought quite well. I always tried to buy with shares which had a very good set of characteristics on the data. And when I was at Goldman's, I was trying to apply some of those principles to the client portfolios, but invariably they wouldn't let me. So, which probably was quite good at that time, given I was so young and naive.
The clients wouldn't let you?
No, my more seniors. But it was because you always had to sort of stick to the buy list. You had to stick to what they mandated. And actually, that was one of the problems there, is that we're often incentivized to buy what was on the list or to sell to your clients the things that came with the really fat sales commissions. So I think that I struggle with that because of my more scientific background. And I think when I left there and moved on to becoming a more full-time private investor, retail investor, I started applying more of those principles.
Gee, that's a caring father. He not only gave you a portfolio, but a tax-efficient portfolio.
Well, in the UK, they were called PEPs. They were called personal equity plans. And they've now become what are called the ISAs. I'm sure you have similar here, individual savings accounts, they're called now. And they're terrific. You're able to save a certain amount of cash every year into an ISA. And you know, it's free from tax. So, you know, the capital gains tax is no issue. And that's a great benefit. And actually, it's something that is a bit undervalued by so many investors. But not having to actually pay those taxes gives you the opportunity to do different kinds of strategies. So, it was very good of him. And he was always interested in the stock market. And I think that sowed the seed for everything I've done since.
Was there anything in your experience at Goldman's that contributed to your learning?
Well,
or was it more of a reaction to what you learned there?
I think they gave me a very, very good education in, yes, financial statements analysis and in how the industry works and how dealing works and dealing floors work and how that client relationship worked. And especially, but the big takeaway that I took from it was that they weren't necessarily always acting in the client's best interest. And I will give one example, that there was one account that we managed to make a 12% yield on in terms of fees over a 12-month basis. That account was actually a very active account. So the client nearly matched the market that year, but it was extraordinary the kind of commission take that happened off that account. And he actually seemed to be okay with it. He was a bright guy because he was getting huge information flow and also getting into a lot of the .com, you know, hot names that were being floated and so on and so forth. But it just, that headwind that the clients were facing on the fees was really significant. So I think that's the biggest takeaway, is that you've got to be super careful on fees when you have professionals acting on your behalf.
Mm. So what was the transition like going to become a private investor?
My mother got very unwell and eventually she had had cancer before, and cancer came back, and it was really a personal decision that led to me moving on to go and look after her and then have a real think about my future. And so that was a very, you know, personal time, and I'm very glad it did it. And spent time with my siblings and then moved on and had to sort of really think about, do I want to go back into the industry or do I want to do something else? And I actually ended up running a family fund for some time and then really managing on my own personal account as well beyond that. And, you know, having saved up a bit of money from Goldman's and also and some inheritance from my mother, I started taking it a lot more seriously. And that obviously went through the dot-com period, after the dot-com period, and I started building up some pretty significant positions in small caps in the UK market, as the market started bottoming after the dot-com bubble. So that was a really kind of pivotal time in my life.
You had a highly concentrated portfolio at that time. What was it like? You say it was small caps, but was it in any particular sector?
It was, well, I at the time, I didn't realize what a sector-focused bet I was actually making, because they weren't in, they were, so I'll tell you, I started buying a range of shares in amongst the kind of, as the market started recovering. And I started buying, you know, based on strong traits and characteristics that were, you know, using valuation ratios like the PEG ratio. So these were generally profitable companies, but they were, they came with a very strong narrative because they were Chinese AIM shares. So the AIM market in the UK is like the junior market, it's a small cap market, and it has much looser listing requirements. And it can be a bit Wild West. And some of the shares on there that I started picking out, I started noticing these valuation anomalies on these Chinese companies that are listed there. With hindsight, I now know that why they were listing there. But I started buying those up, and I had some very, very good success in some of these shares. There was one called RCG. There was another one called Renasola. And I ended up pyramiding my position up as the prices rose. So there's a lot in the literature about the value of pyramiding. You know, edge in on positions and companies that you like, and then start buying more when they move north. And that was a big part of my trading philosophy then. And I was pretty disciplined on the way in whenever I was buying. But I was starting to make such strong returns in these as it moved through 2004, 5, 6, 7. And I remember, actually, I remember exactly when it was. It was my son, my youngest son, was born here in Sydney in the North Shore Hospital. And I remember that I had had a fantastic year in the markets. And I remember running down the beach. I was up in the northern beaches somewhere and thinking, this is going to be my year, 2007. This is all set. And I'd had a fantastic run in a couple of shares. And one of my shares had become more than 50% of my portfolio. And I think the other one was about 25, 30%. So I had probably 75% of my portfolio in just two names. And I had a little tail of other stocks that hadn't done as well. And I was convinced those big positions were going to run and run. And having that maxim of run your winners, sell your losers, I wasn't going to let my winners go. And that really was the crux of that focused portfolio. And I think I drank a bit from the Kool-Aid of the literature on investing, where there are some books which will tell you, you know, or even quotes from Warren Buffett, that diversification is a hedge for ignorance, or you should, you know, own only five stocks and, you know, keep all your eggs in one basket and watch the basket.
And Warren Buffett's got that thing too, where he talks about only, what is it, like 30 stocks in your whole life?
It's that punch card idea. And of course, you know, I was making fantastic returns in these shares. I really was. I'd done extremely well. One of them had quadrupled on my original purchase price and so on. So I was very, very happy with how I'd done. But I didn't realize what was happening to me on the psychological side of owning these shares in such large size. And really, the attachment I had to those positions sort of led to some pretty negative moments. So that kind of led on to the second part of that story, and which another kind of pivotal thing in my life, which led to setting up Stockopedia and the things I do now. So
you started that answer by mentioning the PEG ratio. Yeah. What is a PEG ratio?
So the PEG ratio I got particularly interested in from a great British stock market classic called the Zulu Principle by an author called Jim Slater. And Jim Slater was a great capitalist. He was a great conglomerate capitalist in the 70s. And he eventually actually went, I think he went, might have gone bust in the 80s, but then he made his fortune back writing children's books and then having a column at the Telegraph. And he eventually went on and wrote this fantastic book called The Zulu Principle, which was all about investing in small caps, but using the data to pick really good shares. And Slater's went on and set up Slater Investments, which is now one of the most successful small cap fund managers in London. He's died now, but he was a big inspiration to everything I've done, actually. And I was always a fan of his work. And he really promoted the PEG ratio, which was the price earnings to growth ratio. So one of the first ratios you learn about is the price to earnings ratio. And that's the price divided by the earnings per share. And it's a very, very simple measure of how expensive a share might be against its earnings. So you kind of find that, you know, very expensive shares can be on a PE of 40 to 60 or more, and very cheap shares can be on PE of 3 to 5 or even lower. And of course, where is your buy point? And it's very contextual to know, you know, which is the right PE ratio for that stock, because it depends on the growth rate. And, you know, much more faster growing or higher quality stock would justify a higher valuation. So you might be willing to buy a share on, you know, 30 times earnings or more if it's a really high quality, great growth stock. But if it's not growing, you wouldn't. And one of the things that Slater did using the PEG ratio is he divided the PE ratio by the earnings growth rate. And that kind of normalizes that number because, you know, as I said, if the number can be anywhere between 1 and 100 or 200 or whatever, how do you know how do you judge it? So, but if you divide by the growth rate, you could then use the PEG ratio and say, well, look, if the value of the PEG ratio is 1 or less, that means the earnings growth is faster than is a higher number than the price earnings ratio. So if you had a company trading on a price earnings ratio of 20 times earnings, but the growth rate was 25% or 30%, that would be, the PEG ratio would be less than 1. And of course, if a company was on a lower PE ratio, it could be on a lower growth rate, but the PEG ratio could still similarly be below 1. And he looked for shares that were on a PEG of less than 0.75. And that meant you were buying growth at a reasonable price. And mm-hmm. I think that's a very powerful idea. And it's always been a very perennial idea for all investors. If you can buy growth at a reasonable price and do that, you know, habitually, you can do well in the market. So that's always a principle that I've had in a lot of my investing. I always keep an eye on the PEG ratio, and we publish it on the site, you know, as one of the key ratios on the page. So.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Okay, so there you are on the northern beaches of Sydney. You're running down the beach in slow motion with the hair ruffling you in the wind. And then what happened?
Well, a very, very difficult year, because the markets in the UK started dropping, and especially in Chinese AIM shares. And my two biggest holdings were in this Chinese sector. So it was, you know, it was more of a geographic similarity that the business sectors were completely different. You know, one was in sort of electronics, another one in solar.
But geographically,
but correlated. They were all Chinese. Yeah. And then they started selling off. But at the same time, the Chinese stock market, the Shenzhen and everything, were rocketing. They were going higher and higher and higher. And I was thinking to myself, well, mine are going down, but China's going up. Okay, mine are going to go up. And what I realized afterwards was that you couldn't sell the Chinese markets inside China. Like, they were locked out from international investors. So they were selling Chinese shares everywhere else. And that really was the beginning of pretty negative runs. So, you know, I was anchored on the prices I was at and the highs, and the valuations were still very low on those shares. But I was convinced in the narrative of where these would end up. And then, of course, the rest of the market then topped later that year and started coming down too. So it was like a double whammy. And I was just very, very attached. And it took me a year to really get out of my positions. But by then, my portfolio was down 50% or so. And thank God I got out when I did.
But 50% from the high?
Or? Yeah, it was 50% from the high. And it was a... Yeah, I'd started to think that this was my financial freedom. My financial freedom kind of went up in smoke when all that started happening. So, it was a huge learning curve and deeply, deeply disappointing. And I was very glad I got out when I did, because actually one of those companies, my biggest position, ended up, I think it topped at about 140 pence. And I think I ended up getting out of that one at about 60, 65. And then it eventually went all the way down to 1p. Ended up being a fraud. ended up being a actual fraud where the CEO disappeared. It was a very strange circumstance, and it just goes to show that you've got to really, really have a lot of trust in the underlying ethics of the business. And often I found that foreign listed companies that come to the London Stock Exchange on that junior market, they're doing it for a reason. And I've seen companies from other countries around the world do the same thing and end up being similar. Not say all of them are at all, but you find that there is it's an odds thing. So I learned a big lesson in that.
Okay, so that was one lesson. Was there any other major lesson that you took away from that?
Well, it was all really the sort of behavioral aspects of it. I was very, very much so. The psychological biases that we go through in, you know, becoming very attached to our shares, becoming really overconfident. I had huge overconfidence. I remember telling my wife that my main position was going to quintuple by Christmas or something like that. And you then search for all the information that confirms your opinion. We scan the news to find every story that actually that agrees with us. And that is it's a human trait. We always search our environment to confirm that we're right on things. We don't look for conflicting ideas and conflicting advice. So that was a huge lesson. And I was very, very attached to the fairy tale ending, the kind of, I think it's known as the narrative fallacy now, the fact that stories, we all believe in a Hollywood ending, and we think that you know, a share has got to end up in that closure of the story that we're looking for. But the reality is messy, and it doesn't work like that. So these are all kind of behavioral traits that we fall into that tend to make us hang on to shares too long. And then, of course, we refuse to sell them and we lose all our discipline. And I think that's what happened to me. I lost my discipline on the sell side, and whereas I always had discipline on the buy side, but the sell side discipline was very poor.
So what was the process then, taking that and the experience and then moving on to founding Stockopedia?
At that time, a great friend of mine had been working in private equity, which became a bit unstuck during that deleveraging process. And the two of us started exploring the idea of starting a website to take some of these ideas and really try and improve the lot of retail investors in the UK and hopefully eventually abroad. And we looked at trying to find a good data supplier, and we built a website. Most of it was sort of the mechanics of learning to build a website, having not done it before. And we sort of, you know, got competitive about trying to learn to code and trying to put something together and patch it all up. And we did that reasonably okay. It worked. It was gathering interest. But I always had this idea of us building a subscription data service, because the ones that were available were either only desktop software you had to have on maybe just a Windows machine or a sort of desktop app, but there was nothing really very high quality online. And I found that the majority of websites had very poor quality data, because the data was always used as clickbait. Mm. And because it's used as clickbait, they don't invest in the quality of the data, because they're trying to sell, most financial websites are trying to sell advertising. So they want the data there so that people will click around, but they don't live and die by the quality of that data. So I kind
of... And that data can be very expensive as well to access.
It can. And it is. And the thing is, that really is a difference. Paying for data makes sense, because you know that if you are paying for it I'm talking my own book here, but this is the reason I set up the biz, is because we don't run any advertising. It's all just paid for by our subscribers. But if we don't do a good job on the data, then people won't subscribe, because you can get data for free here, there and everywhere, but it's just not high quality enough. So we've wanted to find a way to make it reasonably priced enough so that we could actually attract that clientele. And then one thing led to another, and we managed to get find the suppliers who could give us the raw data that we could do our magic on. And as that we were going through that process, I was going through a complete re-education in what works in investing, because I recognized that a lot of what I'd learned up to date hadn't necessarily been that beneficial for me. And I dove straight into, you know, all the behavioral finance side of it, as well as all of the more quantitative academic aspects of investing, which is something I hadn't gotten education in when I was in the city or at Goldman's. But it's something I self-educated on, because you started to find there was just so much free publication of academic papers. There are some great stock market classics. And we started weaving all of these key themes and ideas into everything that we, in real ethos and foundation of the service, as we started building it up. So that was probably one of the best educational, self-educational periods that I've ever been through. And while I was sort of mourning this loss of capital and the terrible, terribly stupid things I'd done with my own money. So anyway, there you go.
A big part of it was getting, I saw a mention on your website that you wanted institutional grade information, institutional grade financial data. At the time, what was the difference between what was available to ordinary investors and what the instos had?
Well, there were some data suppliers who had been set up just locally in the UK, and they had quite mixed quality, and they did kind of pre-compute a few financial ratios, but they didn't take all the nuances of financial statements into account. They didn't have necessarily the granular data required to really carve out the best quality ratios. Because even if you take a PEG ratio, there are lots of things that go into that. And there's all kinds of companies will report their earnings in all kinds of different ways, and they have different year-end dates, and they have all their obviously simple things like different currencies, but they might not take into account that a company has dual listings or A and B shares, which are some of the complexities of how companies list their shares on the market. And you need to really calculate a really valid sort of earnings number which takes these factors into account to be able to do
to appropriately
a good job.
Weight those different
yeah,
kinds
exactly.
of factors that are available in there. Yeah.
And that's just a very simple example, but there's a lot more complex ones. And so we wanted to try and find a very good institutional quality data provider that gave us much more granular financial statements data so that we could make the adjustments necessary to calculate and good sets of fields which could allow us to do valid comparisons against companies. Because when you're doing comparisons across the market and you're looking more cross-sectionally, being able to compare like for like makes such a difference.
So part of the process of putting together Stockopedia was looking at some of the academic research that you referred to before.
Yep.
And you mentioned factor investing. Well, on the website, that's mentioned as factor investing. What is factor? Is that the correct
yes,
word? Factor
that, investing?
Yeah, factor investing.
The way to understand that, and that's something we actually labeled it as much later as it became a theme in the industry. But ultimately, the way of thinking about it is that shares are driven by certain traits or characteristics that have now sort of become known as factors. But for example, if you were to take the price earnings ratio, the P ratio we talked about earlier, and sort the market from cheapest to most expensive by that ratio, and you could then chop up the market into buckets. So say you took five different buckets in increase from the cheapest to the most expensive, and then track it as a portfolio over time, and find you would find if you did that, and then every year you did the same thing and you moved the cheapest portfolio into the next set of cheapest stocks a year later because they all change in price individually over the year. And if you track that over time, over the very, very long term, you tend to find that cheaper stocks outperform more expensive stocks. And so that became an idea. One of the most studied ideas was this kind of idea of value investing, or that the value factor is a powerful and pervasive and enduring factor in the market. So on almost all of these price ratios where you measure valuation, and this is a common theme all around the world, you find that that cheap bucket of shares, not every year, and in many periods it underperforms, but over the long term, you tend to find that the more inexpensive classes of shares will tend to outperform. So that's kind of the value factor. And then there are other factors. I'll just quickly brief you on them. So the quality factor is looking at the most profitable shares in the market. And again, doing the same thing, sort the market by profitability. And you can look at quality in terms of cash flow, profitability, high margins. Are they self-funding, high return on capital, stable margins? Kind of things Warren Buffett really likes. And higher quality shares have a tendency to beat the opposite. I like calling them junk shares, but they're your kind of capital destroying companies. So, or companies that need a lot of capital constantly to keep going. And you find those sorts of shares, which are always on a whim and a prayer, and they've got a story. They always have a story. It's that old saying of, there's a lot of mining stocks in Australia, but that old Mark Twain quote of, what's a mine is a hole in the ground with a lure at the top. But, you find that so often in the market, whether it's you're going after a blue sky technology or some significant resource or whatever it is, but they need so much capital to get to that point of positive cash flow.
And that's why they're on the market, aren't they? They need capital.
Exactly, they do need capital, yeah. But it's a bit of a lottery. Yeah. And you find that those types of stocks underperform over the long term, and whereas the high quality ones tend to keep outperforming. And then the last one I kind of focus on is momentum, which is this strange idea that shares that are breaking out or have strong share price strength tend to keep having share price strength. So winning begets winning, and the opposite, losing begets losing. And they're all, it's a strange phenomenon. But if you were to buy the sort of top 20 stocks by their highest share price strength over the last 12 and 6 months, and you do that every year, you find you tend to outperform. And it's a hugely pervasive phenomenon that most people can't really fathom, but it's like it's based on behavioral biases. So these factors, and there are some others, like small caps tend to beat big caps and low risk shares tend to beat high risk shares. But if they are kind of a canopy of what you might call factors and factor investing. And I think this is what I've taken into my investing, is that it's less about the individual share. Like getting consistent returns in the stock market is less about buying the individual story of the share and more about making sure that you're exposed to these factors, that you buy stocks that have these characteristics and you're disciplined about it. So the disciplined enactment of a strategy of owning shares that are good quality, that are good value, that are strong momentum, that is the kind of thing which leads to continually positive returns. And if you lose that discipline, you don't do so well. And so all those things I talked about, my personal issues in the financial crisis, was all about me breaking those rules. Like I got in on the good factors. They were generally quite good, value and quality shares. I thought they were. But actually what unfolded was that I just fell in love with the story and I lost my discipline. And I think that's, in an essence, the idea of factor investing, is trying to keep that strong, I call it strong factor exposure. But it means you're going to let shares go after a year or however long when they no longer have those traits. When they, it embeds that discipline into your process. And I think that's...
And bypass your psychology, presumably,
exactly,
as well.
Yeah.
And that's a big part of it. You want to bypass people's psychological biases.
Definitely. Absolutely. And it is the hardest thing to do, because we are all prone... I can't help myself. I mean, I try not to learn about the shares I invest in, because I believe now so strongly that this idea of factors is so much more powerful if you want to continually try and beat the market. Of course, if you just want to get to know the companies and the management of the stocks you own, and people have different motivations in the market. But I'm particularly interested in trying to sort of beat the market, and so that's the way that I think it works best.
Mm. Tell us about the process of coaching investors, because it's not just about handing out tickers, is it, Stockopedia?
No.
Which is what a lot of people want.
That's right. I think it's that ethic of, give a man a fish versus teach a man to fish. If you teach a man to fish, they can go and find their fish for life. You just give them fish, they're just dependent on you. But we wanted to try and educate people about the kinds of characteristics of stocks that historically have done well, and let people go and pick their own shares, but with a supporting environment which helped them understand if the shares they were looking at were in that class of shares that historically have done very well. So, again, looking at those factors, and we rank the market for quality. We have these ranks between 0 and 100 for quality, value, momentum, and it gives this fantastic scoring system so that anybody can see, if it's a 90 plus ranked share, that's in the top 10% ranked shares in the market. That means it's in a segment that historically has outperformed. Doesn't mean that stock will outperform next year or the year after, but it means that you're kind of, if you're picking shares in, you're not shooting fish in a barrel, but you've got higher odds. And that really allows people to have more confidence in their decisions. And I think a lot of what we try and do is give sort of data-driven product or features which help people have more confidence in their decisions. Of course, everybody knows they're self-reliant DIY investor. And, you know, so, and I've actually never had, really ever had a complaint from someone, because they, everybody knows that the ethos is that they're making their own decisions. We're there as an aid to that. And we give them the data that helps them make fantastic decisions. So I think generally the environment we've created, while there's community and there is publishing and there is, you know, we do a lot of on the educational side, but the data is really there as the primary kind of crux and support, which helps people make much more kind of guided investment decisions. And I think that is, I guess, the coaching aspect rather than just giving people tickers, as you say. So I hope that answers the question.
Let's move on to Stockopedia in Australia. So Stockopedia is originally UK and based there. Actually, is just before we move on, are you covering stocks from all over the world?
Yes, we are. We don't have fully global coverage, although we're planning on extending to that. The thing is, so we do cover the Americas and, well, North America, UK, Europe, some of Asia and Australasia, Australia, New Zealand. And we have had that coverage for some time now, but we're thinking about expanding to Latin America and some of the other regions we don't cover, because we actually have the fundamental data. People have a great home bias in their investing. So most people don't want to go and take on other regions unless, you know, perhaps it's America, you know, everybody, because everyone's got Google or, you know, Microsoft products or whatever it is. So, but generally, you know, they have a very strong home bias for their investment portfolios. And that's a thing that happens all over the world. So yes, we do have other regions, but I think the UK has been our home. But I guess because my original co-founder is a Kiwi, very old friend of mine, and I'm married to an Australian, so we always thought, well, Australia would be this is the one, and then maybe
for those
we'll be
beaches
able
to run down on
exactly,
the beaches,
and to be able to get out of the UK in winter is, I think, on a consistent basis is a great dream my wife and I have had.
Oh, that's been a major part of the business plan, has it?
Certainly, my wife's aspect of it.
Yeah,
but no.
But yeah, tell us about coming to Australia and Stockopedia's place here.
Absolutely. So some people started subscribing from down here. It may have started as expats and, you know, British people down here, but then that started growing. And we thought, well, look, let's take this more seriously. And I think earlier in the year, we began, kind of made a commitment and thought, let's try and build a business here, and didn't know what was going to happen. And then we led on to meeting Elio and Chris.
Who's lurking in the background just here.
That's right, Elio D'Amato.
Being very, very quiet. Say hi, Elio.
Hello, everyone. It's very great. It's great to be here. Great discussion.
And so Elio and Chris Batchelor, who both have great experience of running similar services in the Aussie market. And we got talking, and one thing led to another. And through the year, we gradually started configuring the site. So we did quite a lot of development work to try and make it much more better localized for Australian investors. And there's still a little bit to go, but we've made a lot of configuration changes on the way that it's represented, and especially for how the data is represented. We needed to sort of deal with all kinds of strange decimal place differences of how prices are published here versus the UK. And there's still some more to go, but we'll be continually improving that, and based on their feedback as well. And then just literally a few weeks ago, we signed a partnership agreement, and these guys are taking it on and taking on the challenge of growing it into the Aussie market.
And how can listeners find out more about Stockopedia here in Australia?
Well, if you can just go to stockopedia.com, and you'll find lots of information on the site. And there's a, you know, there are free trials of the service. And also we have there's a lot of material available for reading and download on the site, but also there's a chat, little chat icon in the bottom right of the page where you can actually sort of, you know, ask questions. And I know I've just done a webinar with Elio yesterday. Well, today actually, I think, and we are that will be available for people to learn more, and there'll be other things like that. So it'll be great to do.
Ed Croft, thanks very much for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Phil. Great to be here. Cheers.
If you found this podcast helpful, please tell a friend, especially if it's someone who needs to start thinking about investing for their future. You'll be helping them and helping me to keep this show on the road.
Shares for Beginners is for information and educational purposes only. It isn't financial advice, and you shouldn't buy or sell any investments based on what you've heard here. Any opinion or commentary is the view of the speaker only, not Shares for Beginners. This podcast doesn't replace professional advice regarding your personal financial needs, circumstances, or current situation.
And thank you for listening to my podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.